ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, where we're still doing what we've done for nearly 40 years, examining what really matters in this changing world.
It's a power grab in advance.
And it felt fugitive, an alternative.
And people were willing to take risks.
Hear it now with four brand new episodes each week on the ABC Listen app.
When a child is born, so too is a mother. This idea, known as matrescence, was first conceived of in the 1970s by the American medical anthropologist Dana Raphael. Now, parenting in 2025, of course, looks very different in many ways, but some things haven't changed much at all. And today on Big Ideas, the profound yet often unacknowledged transformation of motherhood.
The brain changes in this transition are as seismic and dramatic as those in adolescence. I found that really kind of soothing because I felt very kind of out of my skin and kind of uncomfortable and a bit like an adolescent at that time. And knowing that actually my brain was changing and, you know, significant things were happening was a relief to discover.
And hello, I'm Natasha Mitchell. This is ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. In her book Matrescence on the Metamorphosis of Pregnancy, Childbirth and Motherhood, British science journalist Lucy Jones writes, "The closest I had ever been to death, to birth, to growth, to the co-conscious, to rapture, to rupture, was, according to the world around me, boring." And she interrogates the many ways that this transition has been neglected by society, by science, by medicine, even by philosophy. Lucy Jones joins us on Big Ideas today as a guest of the All About Women Festival at the Sydney Opera House on Gadigal Country. And she's speaking with host, ABC journalist and author of the book The Parenthood Dilemma, Procreation in an Age of Uncertainty, Gina Rushton.
Now, I had to step up with quite short notice as the wonderful Michelle Law couldn't make it today. But it meant that I had this really unique experience of reading this brilliant book in a couple of days. And it is a clear and clever articulation of all that is wrong with the mythology about motherhood that we've all been marinating in for most of our lives. It is infuriating, it is energizing, and it leaves no space for the sentimental or the superstitious. It is poetic, it is personal, and it's political. And I'll be buying it for every mother in my life. This copy here is for my best friend who's about to have her baby. So I want to start the conversation with the book's title and the concept that I know so many people have found really helpful. How did you come to learn about matrescence and could you define it for us?
Sure. Thank you, Gina. And hi, everyone. It's so nice to be here with you all. Let me go back a little bit. I had my first child, a daughter, in 2016. And while I had always wanted children, I became a mother knowing very little about... It's lovely to have babies here, by the way. They're so welcome. I knew that having a child would be kind of the most challenging and kind of a great responsibility in my life. But I'm kind of ashamed to say this, but I've written a whole book about it, so that ship has sailed. I thought that my body would be a bit like a kind of box or a pot. I carried my children, though of course not all mothers do, and I thought that she would grow in my body and then I'd give birth to her and kind of go back to who I was before, but with this, you know, huge additional responsibility. And the reality was so different. So in those early months of new motherhood, the only place I could really find myself was in reading Kafka's Metamorphosis, which, if anyone doesn't know it, it's a story about the traveling salesman, Gregor Samsa, who suddenly transforms into a giant beetle overnight. And he kind of finds himself on his back, like with his legs waggling around, on his own in his room with his family, kind of outside, isolated, thinking, what have I turned into? And for quite a long time, I found the experience, though my baby was spectacular, as all babies are, very discombobulating. Mm. So everything felt different. My brain, my body, how I felt society expected me to behave, my role, my work, my identity, my relationships. Mm. And I really had thought pregnancy would be a kind of transient hormonal experience, a bit like a kind of long period or something. And actually, I felt that my entire being had really altered. And for a while, you know, in my antenatal information, like, no one had mentioned that anything would change kind of with me. It was all about how to change a nappy or, you know, the birth and so on. So I became quite silent for a while, and I was diagnosed with postnatal depression, and I was quite kind of silently freaked out. And then about 9 months in, my baby was 9 months old, I read a piece in the New York Times by the reproductive psychiatrist Alexandra Sachs called The Birth of a Mother. And in it, she wrote this word, matrescence, which I had never seen before. And she described it as, quite simply, the process of becoming a mother. And she was quoting from the late American anthropologist Dana Raphael, who in the 70s coined this term, having traveled and seen how in most societies and cultures in the world, becoming a mother is seen as a almost kind of traumatic existential life crisis where a new mother will need people supporting her. You know, there's a newborn mother, there's changes, there's vulnerability and so on. And Dana Raphael contrasted that with the situation in the States, which is, you know, you have a baby in a hospital, you're out in a couple of days and you're basically kind of left to it. And I found that reading that word and reading about this process just utterly transformative. I remember the moment my shoulders kind of dropped. I felt like I could take a deep breath and realize that what I was going through was quite a kind of normal transition in a way. It was a transition that my society and culture had neglected or forgotten. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are lots of reasons why it can be less or more difficult, but I felt kind of, I guess, liberated or grounded or relieved, you know, that there wasn't something kind of wrong with me, that actually this was a transition. And, you know, that's a simple definition of it, the process of becoming mother. Mm. Though, of course, you know, it's not simple at all. And for everyone, it will be an individual experience and is very influenced by the structures in our society. So neoliberal capitalism, white supremacy culture, inequality. Mm. My book is called Matrescence, but it's very much about my matrescence.
Yeah.
And I'll end on this. Fortunately for me, at the time that this article was written, there was this enormous and is ongoing kind of explosion of science of the parental brain. Mm. So maternal brain science and parental brain science showing what many mothers know, which is that there is a significant change that happens to the brain.
So overdue. And we're going to talk about those changes now, actually. So the book itself is structured really poetically with these vignettes that capture the wonder and the tragedy of the natural world and the ways in which the experiences of pregnancy and birth and motherhood mirror that wilderness, I guess. What is actually occurring within our bodies during matrescence, and what are the functions of these biological changes?
So the reason why I used the nature kind of stories and the ecological vignettes was because everything I had absorbed about motherhood was so at odds with my experience. So, you know, I was influenced by the kind of, you know, the maternal ideal. I'd grown up with kind of iconography of, you know, Mary, the mother of Joseph, on the walls, where, you know, like, Jesus was never like having a tantrum or like trying to like bite his mother. And I had understood that, you know, motherhood would be hard, but that it was natural in terms of, like, I would naturally know what to do and naturally have a maternal instinct, that birth would be fine if I did all my breathing exercises, that breastfeeding would be fine if I fed on demand and fed all the time. And my experience was that that just wasn't the case. My birth was quite chaotic and extremely painful. Breastfeeding, I didn't have enough milk. I had to supplement, felt like a complete failure. Had an instinct to love and care for my child, but she cried all the time and I didn't really know what to do. And as someone who absolutely loves the natural world and was quite seduced by this idea of kind of natural motherhood, I found it quite interesting to actually, you know, kind of throw away all the books, which were kind of pastel-hued pictures of this kind of fictional fantasy of motherhood, and go into the woods and think about what the world is actually like and how, you know, caterpillars turn into butterflies, and in that journey they become a kind of goo where they completely break down for a while. Or how, like, so many spiders eat their own mothers. And often, you know, I'd end the day with a toddler and feel kind of devoured. And, you know, things like the moon. They think now that the moon was once in the earth and then it was kind of by luck or chance kind of created. It's called synestia. It kind of erupted from the earth. Like, there were these kind of stories that I grounded myself in, and they were appealing to me also in the form of the book, because I wanted to have stories that would be interesting to anyone, because of course we all go through different transitions. And it felt that my culture was telling me to go bounce back to the person I was before, essentially a worker, and to not change and to hide any kind of evidence of my vulnerability or dependency. And in fact, looking to the wider world, which, like, the hallmark of our earth is change and process and transition, was very liberating. So how does it change the body and the brain? That was your
big
question.
It's a big one.
I'll mention a couple of the areas that I think are really exciting and illuminating. One is the emerging neuroscience. So in 2016, which was the year my daughter was born, the first landmark, kind of groundbreaking study was published for the first time, which showed that pregnancy renders pronounced and significant changes in the brain. And there's this kind of amazing matriarchy with a few men of neuroscientists across the world at the moment who are kind of building on this work. And it is showing us a number of things. One is that the brain changes in this transition are as seismic and dramatic as those in adolescence. I found that really kind of soothing, because I felt very kind of out of my skin and kind of uncomfortable and a bit like an adolescent at that time. And knowing that actually my brain was changing and, you know, significant things were happening was a relief to discover. And, you know, these are good changes. They are there to help, you know, people care for an infant. They're also obviously not just associated with pregnancy. So we know that fathers' brain changes, and of course, non-gestational mothers' brain changes, and adoptive parents' and caregiver brains change, which makes sense. We evolved in collective caregiving networks. We all have the neural circuitry to give care. And I noticed that in my husband. Like, although at the very beginning I had this kind of hypervigilance, I noticed that as he spent more time with our baby, that the baby was almost changing his brain. And that's what the evidence, the science shows, is that, you know, with the hands-on affectionate care, you know, all of our brains can change. But it also means that there's a vulnerability. So when the brain is in a plastic state, there's a lot of neuroplasticity, it's vulnerable to severe stress. And the work of Pil-young Kim has shown us that particularly women who are living in poverty, facing systemic racism, domestic violence, a child with additional health needs, isolation, are much more at risk because there is this vulnerability. And, you know, we know so little about postnatal mental illnesses. I think it's, of all the neuroscience studies, 0.5% are about women's brains. Like, we know more about the deep ocean and outer space than we do about women's brains. So I feel like we're on a kind of, at the beginning of really being able to know what's happening in this transition and how to support people. Another amazing area is microchimerism. So when my daughter was born, I kind of never felt that she'd fully left my body. I kind of felt like I'd been kind of hijacked, and in a way, like I kind of could get to her in the middle of the night when she was crying, kind of like a zombie. Like, it was almost like, you know, I was so focused on her. And one of the really interesting areas shows that there's this bidirectional transfer of cells between the fetus and the mother or pregnant person. So fetal cells will cross the placenta and maternal cells will cross the placenta into the fetus. And so that means that, you know, we have the cells of our mothers remaining within our bodies. I mean, it's quite a kind of profound, moving kind of concept. And the science doesn't exactly know why this is. So it could be that these cells are there to help with attachment and lactation. They've been found at sites of repair. Mm-hmm. So they could, it's like repair of cesarean scars. Mm-hmm. They've also been found at sites of disease and inflammation. They could just be kind of byproducts. Mm-hmm. But certainly there are these kind of lifelong consequences of this kind of profound and intricate connection. Yeah, that was a long answer, sorry.
No, it's fascinating. I loved as well that they were found in siblings. That part of the book was so interesting that it's not just
I don't think my younger brother's that thrilled about that. Let's get my cells in him.
So often work about reproductive health can be sidelined or dismissed, particularly, ironically, if it involves personal testimony. And Matrescence is heavily researched. It delves into neuroscience, evolutionary biology, all the stuff we've just talked about there, sociology, cultural history. But it also involves memoir, in which you used your own postpartum body as a site of interrogation and scientific observation. I'd love to hear about your writing process and the considerations you made in sort of blending those two things together.
Sure. As I mentioned, like, a book about matrescence would be hundreds of volumes long. So this is very much predominantly memoir. And it was a book, the driving urge of writing it was to try and make sense of what was happening to me and understand the transition. And my writing is quite solipsistic, but it was equally important for me to try and kind of draw attention to and think about and interrogate the wider structures and systems and the kind of grotesque disadvantages in this transition. I don't think I could have written it at a time with young children without this deeply personal need to kind of read everything I could about it and to understand, kind of for my psychological survival almost. But I also found it a really powerful avenue to look at our society. So if you look at how we treat the vulnerable, it tells you a lot about what we value and what we devalue. And it was very liberating, but it was also very exposing to write so personally. And I think I was quite taken aback by, like, I've been written to by many, probably thousands of women now in the last year and a half. And it's been quite bittersweet because there is a lot of trauma out there, a lot of silenced people and stigma and a lack of, I think, spaces where people can go and be cared for and looked after.
Think about that the next time you see a parent pushing a pram. On Big Ideas on ABC Radio National, I'm Natasha Mitchell, bringing you the British science journalist Lucy Jones, who's author of the book Matrescence, on the metamorphosis of pregnancy, childbirth and motherhood. And she's speaking at the Sydney Opera House's All About Women Festival with journalist and author Gina Rushton. And if you're an exhausted parent listening along right now, or you know one, have you ever stopped to consider what capitalism has to do with all this?
There's a chapter in the book titled Care Work and Creativity in Late-Stage Capitalism, which I loved, in which you articulate that state of discombobulation that motherhood leaves you in when we've all been trained for so long to forge our identities through work, through professional achievement and success. And suddenly, in the face of motherhood with everything that it demands of you, that vanishes, at least for a period, for many people. As a writer, I wondered how and when you found the time to return to writing while mothering young children, and what support you needed, and at a practical level in order to write this book when so much of the mental load and the primary caregiver role can fall on women?
Yeah, well, writing is my job, is my income. So, you know, I was lucky to sell a book, which was like the only book that I think I could have written at that point, because I was writing it and I was trying to understand it kind of obsessively. I was lucky that it was all I could think about. I wrote it over a really long period. So I started making notes when I was pregnant with my first child and then wrote it over many years. And it was finished, I think, a year after my third child was born. And, you know, there's multiple drafts and changes and so on. Importantly, I have a very supportive husband and co-parent and, you know, significant social and material privilege as well. You know, I'm well educated and I have, you know, am able to work in a way, you know, at home. And, you know, that's very much from the advantages that I have been given. Saying that, I also had to rely a lot on credit cards, and I've had periods of burnout and depression, which is it's not uncommon, I think, certainly in the UK, in new mothers trying to kind of get back to work while managing and caregiving, looking after young children within the institution of motherhood, which, as you say, does fall still on women. I think when we know it, because of the evidence, this shows us that burnout is very common. So it was a mix.
So you just touched on then, actually, but I wanted to ask you two questions about the tension between the idea of motherhood as something constructed and something innate. So I would love you to speak to the concept of the maternal instinct, which you spoke about briefly before, and what Adrian Rich calls the institution of motherhood.
Yeah, I found this like so helpful. So I read Of Woman Born by Adrian Rich kind of maybe around the time I saw this word matrescence. So for those who don't know this book, it was written about 50 years ago about Rich's experience of becoming a mother in the 50s. And it amazed me that I could relate so much to what she was saying about the kind of oppressive and cruel maternal ideals, the kind of violence and around birth and kind of taboos around the maternal body and the, you know, the kind of very unequal division of labor. But the thing that kind of really stuck with me and I think is really useful is how she delineated between the experience of being a mother and the institution of motherhood. And I found that useful because I think like many women or new mothers, I felt that anything I said that was negative about becoming a mother or motherhood would suggest that I didn't love my child. And because of Rich's kind of creation of this idea of the institution, it gives us a way of kind of critiquing, analyzing, realizing that we become mothers in a social system and social structure. And I found that super, super helpful. And in terms of the maternal instinct, I was very interested in this mythic idea of kind of being this kind of natural mother and you know, enjoying it all the time. And I felt this kind of pressure to enjoy every minute and, you know, to be ever patient, ever kind, and not to find it difficult. But, you know, I was very shocked by the demands of an infant, and I was very ashamed that I wasn't able to enjoy all of it. And I wanted to look at the history of how the kind of modern mother idea was created, and that took me back to kind of this post-industrial creation of the kind of the naturalizing and the sentimentalizing of motherhood and the separation of the public and the private sphere. So I was looking at the works of kind of Rousseau and other of the most influential thinkers of the day, which was very much about how the mother is, you know, naturally wants to be isolated, cloistered in the home, the hearth, the kind of symbol of love in the home, in contrast to, you know, the factories and industry. And then looking even further back, the evolutionary biology work was so interesting, because I had thought what was traditional was the nuclear family, and that it was the norm, to, you know, have this kind of nuclear setup and for the mother at home to look after the children, basically, and to be okay with that.
Yeah.
And the work of Sarah Blaffer Hurdy in particular shows us that this way of mothering is so unusual and strange compared with the rest of our evolutionary history. So for 99% of our evolutionary history, we lived in collective caregiving networks. Mm-hmm. Research of traditional societies today suggests that there would have been kind of 10 to 15 people supporting the mother and responding to the infant's needs. Mm. So the mother responds about 50% of the time. And for the rest, there's these allo parents, allo mothers, as it's called. Mm. And that made so much sense to me. I had these days where, you know, I'd be so worn out by the crying of the baby and not sleeping, not being able to go to the loo or eat or anything. And I thought, I don't think my nervous system has evolved for this, you know? And I have a very supportive family, but like many people in my culture, we live far away from each other, etc. And I had been raised to be very self-reliant and not ask for help or not really accept help, which I've, you know, have worked on. But it was very instructive and disruptive of the maternal ideal to kind of look back at how this idea of the mother has been created and how it's really weird compared with how we evolved.
I'm only smirking because I have this theory that every panel I do, it ends up in a conversation about how we should be in a commune. Like this literally happened at the panel before where about the baby boycott and why everyone's boycotting it. And it came up again, just like how disillusioned everyone is with the nuclear family and how isolating it is and how lonely it is and how we're not meant to do all of this by ourselves. And it's just amazing how it comes up. I didn't think we'd touch on it, but I'm glad we did. to stay with that kind of tension, something that the book grapples with, and I have to admit I've a strong interest in this because it's one of the things that actually turns me off becoming a parent, and that was the case for so many people I've interviewed about this, is this inherited set of moral standards around motherhood, particularly notions of perfection and the idea that in particular suffering and neglecting your own needs is somehow redemptive and then it's kind of the makings of a good mother. I thought it was so fascinating how you described how almost spontaneously these sort of unexamined moral assumptions about motherhood just came to the surface basically as soon as you were pregnant, really. I wonder like how you feel about, you know, because we are here having these conversations, like do you feel like these, you know, even the most progressive feminist women have internalized these kind of these things that are just like you can only ever end up guilty once you've internalized them. Do you think that it's shifting or...
I think it's really hard to say. I think that, like, if I look back at, like, so when my mum had me in the 80s, the most popular book was, she tells me, How Not to Be a Perfect Parent. Mm. And it was very much the way, you know, the culture of parenting then was kind of your children work around you. And I think that, you know, we've learned a lot about what children need and, you know, emotional regulation and so on. But actually, it's become even more intensive, the expectations on mothers. And I think that's becoming, it's very interesting with the kind of trad wife trajectory as well. And sociologists call this intensive motherhood or total motherhood or immersion motherhood. Mm. And I found that really useful to learn about. And it's basically defined by this kind of cultural norm of it being the mother mostly in charge, giving a lot of time, a lot of resources, always being happy with it. Mm. And, you know, obviously that leads to kind of self-neglect. And I've spent quite a lot of time thinking about like why now in our moment of history is this motherhood kind of the dominant one? Mm-hmm. And it does seem to be kind of across class lines and in most Western cultures and societies. And I'm sure it's because it's kind of in lieu of proper social support. Mm. So with the decades of kind of neoliberal privatization, deregulation, individualism, kind of hyper-capitalism, and fall like austerity, you know, for falling away of social support, mothers are kind of we free ride on kind of mothers basically and caregivers. Like if you look at the wages for housework movement in the 70s. And one of my epigraphs is, you call it love, we call it unpaid labour. Like, it was almost more, like, legit to ask for more childcare or more social support. I think there's, in every generation, I think people have to kind of try and tear down these social norms and structures. But, we think we're very progressive in many ways, but, like, in the UK, for example, women of colour are 4 times more likely to die in childbirth. I mean, that's just grotesque. And I know that there's a similar problem with systemic racism and perinatal care here. And, you know, I think if we look at these, look at this time of becoming mothers, bringing children into the world, we can really uncover a lot of the terrible stuff that our society is doing. And that's why I think matrescence is quite a powerful idea, not just because individually it can be quite helpful, but because it illuminates these kind of these real fault lines in our society.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrifying. If you start looking at care workers' actual labour, then you've got to change the whole economy. You're not just doing it for love.
Yeah, I think there was a statistic that women today spend as much time with their children as in the 1950s while also working. And I think men that spend about kind of half that time or something, or a lot less. Like, it was a real shock to me when I entered motherhood that there is a real inequality there.
So the period of early motherhood can be a time of profound joy, but it can also conjure feelings of lost independence, equality, freedom, and self, and women tend to blame themselves, as we've just said, for this rather than the society which fails to support them. Mental health conditions during the perinatal period are common and in Australia affect about 1 in 5 mothers. Obviously, there are a bunch of factors that go into play with that, chemical and otherwise, but how do you think the patriarchy, capitalism, even feminism contribute to some of these untenable psychological realities that mothers are facing?
So many ways. How many have we got? How long have we got? When you started by mentioning, like, the profound joy, and I think there are a lot of taboos about raising children, and perhaps even one of them is also the joy and the bliss of motherhood. Like, I think that one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book was because I was, you know, shocked by the institution of motherhood. But I also found it very interesting, like, existentially, to kind of carry a person, to be plural, and then to have a child. I mean, that felt to me very absent in any of the literature, culture, feminism that I had kind of grown up with. And so, you know, I wanted to explore that as a, you know, a site of kind of drama and literature. But how does patriarchy and capitalism and feminism...
It's a big question.
Can I swear?
Yes.
Fuck up everything. I don't know. I mean, we can see, in terms of patriarchy, the taboos of the maternal body, I think, are so strong. So I spent some time doing a kind of textual analysis of headlines in the Daily Mail, and I discovered what I call, like, the taut abs imperative. So there'd be this formula of, like, X celebrity flaunts her taut abs 2 weeks after giving birth. So this would just be repeated again and again and again.
Very, you know, helpful.
And there is this, like, very strong bounce back culture about maternal bodies and lots of taboo around, you know, even in terms of breastfeeding. It's like, they want you to breastfeed, but they don't want to see you doing it. You know, and it's just, anyway. And then in terms of capitalism, I think that shows up in so many ways, but I'll just mention, I think perinatal loneliness and, like, the isolation of the nuclear family is a really big problem. So where I live, which is a town in England, thank God we have a library, but there are very few places to kind of go with young children. Like, it's quite a hostile environment. Like, playgrounds are pretty grim. And I mean, I'm sure that might be different here. And I know that, you know, in Berlin, for example, there are family centers, and in different countries it is better. But it feels like in hyper-capitalist society, we don't really want to see children. And we don't really want to see mothers. And that also shows up in the kind of back to work imperative. I love working. Obviously, working is really good for people in so many different ways. But in our kind of obsession with profit and growth in our society, we don't value care. So even if you're a person who has a baby and wants to stay at home looking after the baby, mm-hmm. like that's kind of impossible. Like there's no care wage or way of, you know, valuing that kind of work. And I think, you know, the stigmas around matrescence becoming mothers operate in really different ways according to different kind of groups of people. So there's a writer called Sandra Igwe in England who's written a memoir about becoming a mother as a Black British woman and, you know, how difficult it was for her to ask for help for postnatal depression mm-hmm. because of the racism in the system and the fear of her children being taken away. So there is a lot of issues, and that I'm just scratching the surface.
So you've talked about before becoming a mother, you'd never seen sort of accurate portrayals of matrescence in wider culture, that you'd never seen a painting of a person giving birth, heard a song about pregnancy, or read a book about the loss of self in early motherhood. And also, I guess, representations of maternal ambivalence as well in the wider culture. These days we have at least some examples of that in popular culture, like Ferrante, there's a few examples with some of her books. When we talk about maternal ambivalence, I thought about Night Bitch by Rachel Yoder as well. Are there any examples in pop culture that you think authentically capture either matrescence or maternal ambivalence?
I would mention Night Bitch too. Yeah. I love that book. I haven't seen the film yet. There's a novel called The Nursery by Sylvia Molnar, which is absolutely brilliant and all about the kind of the very wild first weeks of motherhood, the kind of anxiety and the kind of hypervigilance and kind of surreal psychedelic experience of sleep deprivation and terror. I like The Bump. I think that's Aussie show.
Yeah,
right?
I've never seen it.
That's cool. Yeah. I think there are more and more depictions, particularly in the art world. I think there's a lot of interesting art being made. And definitely in the UK, there are kind of this mushrooming movement of writing circles and kind of art making groups for new mothers to kind of get together and be able to kind of express like their births or just kind of, you know, create community and come together. I really believe in the power of the arts and art to process and to express a lot of these a lot of these things. I mean, I guess like I did an English literature degree and we had a canon of like 100 books of like, you know, the classics of English literature. Literally none of them had a scene of childbirth in them. And that just kind of makes me furious. Like I think it's such an interesting thing and an interesting, like a moment of drama. And
it's so dramatic. It's ripe for literature.
It is, yeah. And often, I mean, I guess in the movies, it's often depicted in this kind of very Hollywood way. But yeah, I think those are increasing, those portrayals.
I was just like going through my head, the only book I can think of where there was a childbirth scene was Blue Ticket by Sophie McIntosh.
And yeah.
And there's a really good childbirth scene in that, but I can't think of a single other.
No. Example. Well, maternal subjectivity, I think in all, you know, obviously being a mother is a very long process. I'm only at the beginning, but so I don't know about what it's like, but maternal subjectivity is so kind of neglected and disavowed. Like I kind of grew up in a culture which I think was quite disparaging of mothers. Mm. You know, being mumsy was like, yeah. You did not want to be mumsy. And mumsy. It's kind of embarrassing. It's kind of cringe. Like, you know, and I think that comes from a kind of fear of dependency, actually, and a kind of the private realm of vulnerability and dependency is so in contrast to our public world of, you know, our kind of fetishized freedom and independence and autonomy, which I have definitely benefited from. Mm. But it only works if you keep caregiving hidden. You know, it's not included in GDP. So, like, basically GDP is a fiction because we pretend that there's not loads of people, mostly women, at home doing the labour of creating workers and sustaining workers.
We might just actually go to the question about, for people just wanting to learn more about matrescence, are there any resources that you'd recommend for further reading or study? Or
There's an amazing neuroscientist called Jody Polusky. She runs a podcast called, I think, Mummy Brain Revisited. She's published a lot on this kind of misnomer of baby brain. You know, this kind of misogynistic idea that if you have a baby, your brain turns to mush. And like, while obviously if you're sleep deprived, like there can be some memory issues, but like that's just like outdated idea. And she's brilliant. Like she's really worth following. She's always posting about kind of the latest brain research and so on.
Cool.
Demeter Press, which is based in Canada and run by Andrea O'Reilly, published so much about motherhood studies and matrescence.
Oh, cool.
They're worth looking at if you're interested.
And if you haven't seen the movie Night Bitch with Amy Adams, I'm told by my Big Ideas colleague Claire Slattery, it is a strong recommend for some accurate and hilarious depictions of matrescence. And with her take on modern motherhood, the British journalist and author Lucy Jones joins us on Big Ideas here on ABC Radio National with me, Natasha Mitchell. Lucy is the author of the acclaimed book Matrescence on the Metamorphosis of Pregnancy, Childbirth and Motherhood. She's with host, journalist and author Gina Rushton and an audience at the Sydney Opera House's All About Women Festival. And look, there are so many dimensions to this experience, aren't there? Trauma, guilt, loss of identity, mental illness, but there's also the good, the delightful, the heart-expanding moments. Lucy now takes some questions from the floor.
I'm still kind of formulating my words in my head, but I was wondering if you could speak to sort of how you went about rediscovering and reclaiming, like, what would you sort of, I mean, it's hard to speak for a whole group of people, but, you know, for people that are going through early motherhood or that are going to be, you know, new mothers, how you went about reclaiming your sense of self and, like, rediscovering yourself after such a huge transition when you just, you don't feel like who you were before?
Yeah, that's a lovely question. Thank you. I think for me, finding friends that I could be very honest with and, you know, creating relationships with people, you know, who you could just be completely honest with was really essential. Starting to learn how to accept and ask for help was really key. And then I think for me, part of kind of finding my new self in this new world was, in a way, a really nice return to my own childhood. So spending time with my children in the woods and outdoors and falling in love with the world again. I love learning. I love the natural world. I love the fact my house is filled with encyclopedias and I'm reading about like space and fossils and all this stuff with my kids. Like that has been so cool and exciting. And actually, like, I write about this a bit in the book, but they kind of taught me, I'm very bad at play, but they've kind of taught me how to be playful again and how to slow down and just spend time just literally watching a bumblebee. And that has been amazing, like this kind of pause in my life and outside the marketplace and also their kind of innate urge to just create for the sake of it. Like that's been so inspiring, you know, and as an adult, I kind of got to the point of I can only make something if it's really good or if it's productive or if I can sell it. And I just, I've seen in these kids that they just naturally need to create and express. And so in a way, you know, they have brought me to a new self, which I am very happy with now, despite all the burnout that happens. You know, it's it's a roller coaster.
Yes, we've got someone up there.
I think my question is more towards the correlation between our new obsession with trauma. I think we are like a generation of people who are obsessed with trauma, right? What happened before to us, what happened in my childhood. Do you think there is a correlation between that obsession with trauma and this isolation that we have now? So we want to see less of our mother-in-law or even our own parents because now there's this new wave of psychology talking about the trauma. So we want to be overprotecting our kids from that trauma. Do you think that that could be also part of the reason that we are isolating ourselves so much from that family network?
That's such an interesting question. I've never kind of thought of it like that, but it's very that's very thought-provoking. I can only speak freely from my own experience with that. And my sense is that we are parenting in an age where, like, the culturally acceptable way of parenting, certainly in kind of my culture, is, you know, often called gentle parenting or conscious parenting or intentional parenting. And that is very at odds with how a lot of people were raised in more authoritative parenting, you know, being smacked and so on. Like, that's just not what happens now. And so I do think that we are living at a time where people are becoming parents and being expected to do things very differently to how they were raised, which is great for the kids, but I think it can be quite triggering and difficult for people in different ways. Saying that, for me, I've kind of created a village who we talk about that stuff. Like, I found it quite a way of bonding with people and kind of overcoming any isolation. You know, we want to parent our children, you know, kindly and gently, and that can be really difficult sometimes, and that can be useful. But I'm not sure is the answer.
Yeah, we might go over to Michael.
Hi, Lucy. I was gifted your book when I was really heavily pregnant, and I kept voice noting my girlfriends in the UK going, I don't know what is wrong with me. I feel like a different person through this pregnancy. And that definitely took me beyond into early parenthood. So thank you for writing your book, because it was a real tool that helped me make sense of what was happening. I'm now 9 months postpartum, on the eve of going back to work tomorrow. So I'm actually here with my friend from work. But I wanted to ask you about, in your studies, have you ever come across anything around research on mum guilt? And any insights and any kind of recommendations or strategies to cope with mum guilt, which is something I think, yeah, on the eve of going back to work is playing on my mind a lot.
Such a good question. And I'm so glad that my book spoke to you, and good luck tomorrow. It's big. Mum guilt, I think, I'm sure there is research. I can't kind of think of any off the top of my head. It's definitely something that I've got a lot of experience of. I mean, I'm in Australia, my three young children are in England. I've been feeling a lot of guilt this weekend, but I think what I've learned is that you're gonna feel guilty, and you just do it anyway. And then you just, you know, a lot of the guilt is kind of confected societal stuff. It seems like literally everyone feels like that. So what I've done is just accept, I'm gonna feel this, and it will pass. And knowing that you're a person too, and, you know, you need to have your needs as well. I think that it can be very, that transition back to work, I found it really difficult too. It's really hard, but I think talking to people about it and expressing it and knowing that you're doing a really good job, whatever you're doing.
A lot of us here wearing Mum for Mum t-shirts. So, and our whole thing is about matrescence, helping. We're a volunteer organisation of 230 volunteers who are supporting mums individually in their homes for a full year and in the last trimester of pregnancy. And it's very much about each individual mother. We speak so much about postnatal depression, but it is so normal now to feel depressed as part of this transition. And I was wondering if we shouldn't be normalizing that experience more and not waiting for a diagnosis. There is grief in the transition, and there's loss in that transition, and maybe unpacking that. And if I could just also say, it's not a sexy subject. It's not, you know, they're much easier charities to support. But what about the attachment of the baby and the effect of a mother who's struggling, and that effect on the baby, which is so much about the long-term future?
What an amazing organisation. Look at you all. That is so cool. I think that we need a biopsychosocial approach to postnatal mental illness. So, you know, we know that, of course, the kind of seismic, dramatic hormonal impact of pregnancy and birth can
cause different types of postnatal mental illness. See, there is this intrinsic biological vulnerability for some women, which happens. And part of my intention with writing the book was to try and work out this question, which is impossible to answer, but which was how much of maternal mental illness is intrinsic and biological, and how much of it could be prevented with a kinder, fairer society. And I think quite a lot. I can only really speak from my own experience, but, you know, from the moment of kind of giving birth in a hospital in London, the care, I had wonderful midwives, but the kind of care from that point was very much kind of focused on the baby, which of course is important, but there was very little, I guess, acknowledgement of kind of potential birth trauma or breastfeeding difficulties. There just wasn't a lot of good care at that point. And then for me, I conceptualize my own experience of postnatal depression as there was a kind of wound, which was, as you say, the grief, the kind of confusion, the loss, the lack of sleep, a very long birth, and then that can tip over into an infection. For me, I've had clinical depression for a lot of my life, so I was susceptible, and you know, it tipped into something different, and I was glad that my treatment worked quickly. But I think that if we could talk about these things, I think birth trauma is such a big problem. I read in a study today, I think 1 in 3 women in Australia in the birth trauma inquiry say they suffered birth trauma. I mean, if we're getting that wrong, and people are entering motherhood, a third are entering motherhood traumatized, that's going to have an impact on your mental health. And I wish there were more people like you guys who were there. And I also think that as a, you know, our governments and our politics, it's a political decision not to invest in adequate maternity care. It's a political decision not to provide quality childcare. These are political things that we need to...
We've got 2 minutes left, so we're going to have one final quick question and quick answer, and then we'll wrap it up. So we'll just go to mic two for the last question.
I've got a 5-year-old daughter. So my question is about how do you experience matrescence now that you are sort of past that hectic newborn phase? How do you look at yourself now compared to pre-children? How do you go through life compared to before? And do you think there's a power to be harnessed in matrescence as an individual, but also as a community, as a society?
What a great question. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that for me, like every child was a different matrescence. So like going from 1 to 2 was its own special kind of challenge. And I'm not sure where the matrescence ever ends. I mean, my eldest child is now 8, but I imagine if you parent of teenagers, parent of older children, your brain's probably changing in different ways and the challenges are different, I'm sure. Matrescence and patrescence is potentially very kind of societally transformative because it forces us to look at what is very hidden. And I do definitely believe there is power in it. I feel, you know, 8 years in, I've probably got over the kind of real roller coaster of it. And I feel that I'm become even more of the person that I was before. Like my boundaries are better. I know what I like. It's kind of allowed me to kind of get rid of some of the dross, which I'm sure many transitions can do for people as well. Thank you.
Please join me in thanking the brilliant Lucy Jones.
Parenthood, it's forever and for no time at all. And that was British journalist and author Lucy Jones. She is the author of Matrescence on the Metamorphosis of Pregnancy, Childbirth and Motherhood. And she was joining host Gina Rushton and a big audience at the Sydney Opera House's All About Women Festival. Thanks to its terrific team. We love working with the Opera House. And you can check out their smorgasbord of festivals and speakers if you're ever over in Gadigal country. Make a night of it. Thanks for joining me on Big Ideas. This is is your front row seat to the best live events on ABC Radio National. We love hearing from you. You can email us your responses to today's program and conversation. Bigideas@abc.net.au is how to get to us. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.